Mango Bay Restaurant, located in the heart of downtown Montreal, 1236 Mackay Street, Suite 201. For reservations, please call 514-875-7082 or visit mangobay.ca. Real food.
Let's get together and feel all right.
The simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This is Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, and you are listening to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM. Bring on the glamour, darling.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised. Are you a queer artist or activist in the Montreal area who wants a platform to discuss your work? Interested in producing radio for QueerCore on CKUT? Send an email to queercoreradio@ckut.ca. That's queercoreradio@ckut.ca. Welcome to the February 8th edition of Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It's 6:04 p.m. On tonight's show, I'm joined by Matilda Bernstein Sycamore from her home in Seattle, Washington, to talk about her latest novel, The Freezer Door, out through Semiotext. A week ago, I phoned Matilda on her landline to try and reschedule our interview and was greeted by a lovely voicemail prompt. A friend in common had informed me that Matilda's answering machine greetings changed frequently and were often topical. I was delighted to know that when Matilda came home from most likely being out for a stroll around Capitol Hill in Seattle, stretching against condos, park benches, and trees, waving to passersby, she would see the flashing light of her answering machine and sit down and listen to my message. There's something wonderfully personal, I think, about leaving a brief and succinct message on someone's machine, a form of phone tag communication that's been almost all but obliterated in our day and age of constant contact, texting, internet DM messaging, and so on and so forth. Who wants to be reachable every second of every day? And yet we're expected to be. The Freezer Door explores themes around alienation and displacement in Seattle, caused by the rapid gentrification and neoliberalization of our cities and our ways of living. It is interested in the contradictions of our lives and the beauty of human connection in unexpected surroundings and circumstances. Most importantly, perhaps, it is a novel that seeks to expose the violence of nostalgia and selective memory, as Matilda navigates her relationship to desire, to touch, and her attempts to discovering an embodied sense of self. My interview with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore.
I hate waking up in the middle of a dream. And yet, this is how we live our lives. We're on the side of a road that isn't really a road. I mean, it's blocked off. Or we're on the side of a road that is really a road. But actually, neither of these roads are really roads because we're in a park. So you can't say two roads diverged. But you can still be part of manifest destiny. I wish I wasn't, but I am. And that's probably the best way to describe gay cruising. What happened to the dream of desire creating something else? That's what I'm wondering. Michael wants to make a historical monument sign mourning the loss of the park as a cruising site, but he's never even cruised the park. I say, why not make it happen instead? And he says, there are only ugly guys there. And when I say all of us are ugly, he says, not you. But can I get distracted by a compliment? Remember Follow the Leader? That was a critique of leadership, right? Why does it feel like no one else learned this lesson? Now I'm in the other space. This one has rooms, but not room. I'm walking in circles, which are actually squares. And then I stop. And then I'm walking in circles, which are actually squares. The moment between the end and the beginning, that's what I want to convey. Something about how the music stops. In this case, I mean literally. The music stops, and then the whole place is darkness. And I wish I could say groaning or moaning, but mostly just quiet and a creak here and there, the flush of the toilet. I'm studying the blackboard over the urinal where people usually write things like BB and 108, but the board's just been erased, so all you see is the way the black surface is peeling off. And I wonder if that makes it harder to write, but I try and can't tell. Maybe I'm covering the blackboard in little hearts. Or maybe just two hearts. Or maybe there are no hearts at all. because this is a sex club. So the most important thing is when I'm changing back into my clothes and I say to the guy next to me in the locker room, why does everyone at a gay bathhouse act like they're straight? What do you mean? He says, like he's straight. If desire is what makes sex possible, then what makes the sex that makes desire impossible?
So it's really good to hear you on the phone. I'm curious to know what it's been like going on all these virtual book tours and being able to visit other cities without having to leave your home in Seattle.
Yeah, it's been really interesting because when the book was about to come out, or let me back up. You know, I wrote the book in the present, right? And so in March, April of last year, the present changed, right? And suddenly I thought, well, how are people going to relate to this book? Like, will it mean anything? Like, does it make any sense at all in this, you know, current pandemic moment? And what was really interesting, as people were starting to read it, even before it came out, people kept telling me, oh my God, it's so relevant. You know, I relate to everything. And I really did not know what they meant. But then once the book came out and people started reviewing it and responding to it in those moments, I realized that some of the themes in the book, in particular alienation and loneliness and searching for connection and the privatization of public space, all of those things are even more relevant to people in a broader sense now, where people who might have like acted like they didn't understand loneliness. I mean, I never believed that anyone doesn't, but now everyone does, right? It's a collective experience of loneliness. Mm. And I also, like before this pandemic, I would never have done anything online, you know, in terms of an event. Like people would invite me to do things sometimes. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. You know, it feels disconnected. And the point for me, I mean, I'm writing the book, I'm writing towards connection. But obviously this is our option now. And so so I started doing these events, and actually I do feel the intimacy and I do feel the connection and I do feel like a spark, and I do get excited by, like, you know, people going off in the chat as I'm talking or reading. And I do actually feel that, you know, and it has been like pretty incredible just the way people are relating to the book on so many deep levels, both in terms of the emotions, in terms of the form, in terms of the content. And so the events, yeah, so it's a little weird because, you know, I'll be on, like really on for like an hour, and then the event ends, like a normal event, you know, then I go on like a walk with a friend and I like wind down and I, you know, lean against trees and but then these events, they end, and then I'm like in my apartment with like an adrenaline rush, and I'm like, oh my God, what just happened? What's going on? So it took a little bit of getting used to, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a term for that. It's like post-meeting, like dread or fatigue or something, where you have this giant high that's happening virtually, and then it just kind of like the bottom falls out of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it's definitely an adrenaline rush. I mean, for me, it's specific to an event. Like anything else I do, like online, there's no high, there's only a low. Like a virtual meeting or something, I'm like, oh my God. But in terms of the events, I do, and part of it, I do feel like I'm able to conjure some of what I would be able to do. Like what I always say is, like, I, you know, in a normal reading, like in a, you know, public space, in a bookstore or an event space, you know, I always tell people, like, whatever you need to do to take care of yourselves, you know, if you need to jump up and down, walk around, laugh, cry, you know, run to the bathroom, have a snack, you know, whatever you need to do to take care of yourselves, please do it. But when we're at home, we all already know that, right? And so I was like, well, maybe can we use that, the comfort of being at home in our own spaces, and combine it with the potential of being here together, even virtually, and imagine or feel into that collective possibility. And I do feel like it's happened.
Yeah, I think we've adapted really well to our circumstances. I still, like you said, I don't often get on the Zoom calls for something that's pleasure. I'd still much prefer to phone someone up for a conversation or go on a walk with someone as a way of coping with the current set of circumstances that we've been dealt.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I was actually really interested. Well, first of all, I wanted to say that I think that the people who have had the privilege to, you know, release works of art during this time, I think they're really going to be important works of art in people's lives. And I think something, you know, it's partially to do with this state that we're all in, where we're all confined. I also think that your work is just, I don't want to say that it's your best work, but maybe it is your best work.
Yeah, feel free. Thank you.
And I think one of the reasons why I think it's your best work is I felt very transported. Not that I don't always feel transported when I read your writing, but maybe just because I have a personal connection to Seattle, I felt like I was drawn into Seattle by reading your book. And I guess this, if Seattle has featured in previous books, because you did live in Seattle before you moved back to Seattle, but what was it like for you to really decide to, you know, mainly focus a book on Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, whenever I start a new book, I start really without an intention of what I'm doing. And so that was definitely true in this case. I just write and write whatever's coming into my head, and I just put it all in one document. And in this case, I did that for a few years. And of course, certain things are drawing my attention, and you know, I know that certain themes are emerging, but I wait until I feel like I've gotten somewhere before I look at it as a whole. And I didn't know exactly where that was. But it was a reading series where they invited me to do, it was called The Furnace. And each time you read one piece to completion, it's just one reader. And, but the theme was writing about Seattle. And I was like, oh, well, this is the writing I have about Seattle. So let me take a look and see what I can pull out. And I knew the parts that I thought were the most polished, but what I arranged for that reading became the beginning of the book. And that was when I realized, oh, the book in a way is this search for, you know, it's about desire and its impossibility. And it's a search for a way to have an embodied self in a world that doesn't allow it. So a world, you know, a gay cruising culture, a world of fags, a world of gentrification, a queer world that supports my intellect, but not necessarily my embodiment, and a world of trauma, a world of Seattle where, you know, people refuse to engage with one another on the street, even if public engagement is why I live in a city. And then also that gentrified mentality. And so I guess Seattle came through in the book because it is, I guess my books are always very place-based. And so I guess the question though of what did it feel like, because that's an interesting question, because what I'm writing about, you know, I'm writing through longing and through loss and through devastation and through desire and through failure and through all of these things. So I guess the felt sense of it is all of those things. and I guess in writing the book, I really did realize, I think this is often true in my work, or maybe even always, But in this book in particular, that I'm writing toward the feeling, and when the feeling can no longer hold, the text itself fractures. And so you can see that, like, right from the beginning, where the first sentence is just, the first page is just one sentence, and that sentence is, one problem with gentrification is that it always gets worse. And then the rest of the sentence is just blank space. And so for me, gentrification is the landscape in which the book takes place, and everything else has to come up against that. And that Seattle that I'm talking about is that, you know, what people in Seattle call the Seattle freeze. You know, in Seattle, people rationalize, you know, it's like when you're walking down the street and, you know, there's someone like a block away and they look kind of interested and you're like, oh, maybe I'll say hi to this person. And then you get closer and, you know, they turn to look at a wall. Or you might even see someone, you know, you like wave to them down the street and they like quickly turn the corner to get away from you. And people in Seattle, they say, oh, well, that's like the Nordic heritage, whatever the hell that means. But what it really is the white picket fence in the eyes. It's the way in which the suburban mentality has conquered urban space. And I feel like all of our gentrified cities are becoming this way. The one that I'm writing about is Seattle. And I wanted to write about it in all of its specificity, you know, in part because that's how I go on living, you know? And so I'm not just writing about, you know, in an abstract sense, I'm writing about my bodily hope for a place where my body can have a home, right? And so that means, you know, I'm writing about the trees, I'm writing about the sky, I'm writing about the rain, I'm writing about these terrible people. And I'm writing about, you know, terrible outfits in the window of the yoga boutique, you know, and I'm writing about walking around trying to find connection and the ways that people do and do not allow that, or going to sex clubs, or going to gay bars because I'm looking for what, I've given up the hope that I can find a space that isn't corrupt. And so I'm going into spaces that I aren't corrupt in order to find what isn't. And so all of that, I kind of want to put on this level playing field in order to see if I can actualize the connection, the dream of the city that I still believe in.
Right. And you kind of, you mentioned towards the end of the novel that you've sought out at the beginning of the book, or at the beginning of these like years in Seattle, these past few years in Seattle, that you want to make more friends that are fags and have sex that is more meaningful. Do you feel like you're closer to that?
Well, this is the wrong moment to ask that after, you know, a year of not being able to go out and meet people.
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah. How is, besides the obvious, how is the pandemic really affected all of the spaces? Because so many of the spaces that are described in the book are the Volunteer Park and Steamworks and Pony Bar are all effectively closed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because in the book, yeah, I'm searching for a place where desire can hold me. And I guess, you know, this dream of desire that as queers we come into. And for me, desire means that desire that has no bounds. And so some of that is desire to get fucked against a tree in a park. And some of that is the desire to, you know, look at the way the light hits a building at a certain time of the day, or like breathe into like the sensation of leaning against a tree, or just that sudden interaction where you have with someone on the street who looks at you in a weird way, or you have just a quick conversation. You know, to me, desire is all of that and more, you know, but I feel like over the years, I feel like my desire hits walls more than it allows for that expansiveness. And so in the book, you know, I'm writing toward all of that possibility. And when it does become actualized and when it's impossible. And I think in a way, like, I think you're asking about my life, you know, if there's a postscript to the book, I guess it would be that sometime after the book ends, I really found a lot of potential for what I'm looking for, which is like touch in everyday life, like touch, you know, not just touch that's about sex, you know, but just having like physical connection with other people that feels, that allows me to like exist in the world in a different way. And I found a lot of that through dance, and especially ecstatic dance and contact improv. And none of that is sexual touch necessarily, but it's, I think I feel most alive when I'm dancing. And if other people can meet that, you know, in the book, I talk a lot about, like, I go to Pony, this bar on Capitol Hill in my neighborhood, and I'm dancing, and that's when I'm most unafraid. And no one will even, you know, no one will engage with me. Like, they refuse to. It's too scary for them. And, but at, like, ecstatic dance or contact improv, that's why everyone's there. And so I think, like, just before this pandemic started, or before we became aware of it, and before, you know, we went into all these, you know, quarantine, lockdown, et cetera, I felt like, oh, I have maybe like 50% of the touch I want in my life. And it was basically all from that, you know, and then, you know, these limitations started and all these spaces closed, and then I went to zero. And I'm not that far from zero now. So, you know, in terms of touching other people, so I guess, so it's become a much more solitary exploration. So, and I guess that the question for me now is like, how not to just like completely fall apart, you know, because I know what I want and I have a sense in some ways of how to get there, but the way I can get there are not options now. And I'm not sure there is a foreseeable, I mean, it's not going to happen for a long time, you know? Because I will say that I feel like I have found way more pleasure and possibility through dancing and physical contact than almost any sexual experience or romantic experience that I've had over the last decade. And that communal dance, you know, in a public space is like way more impossible than anything I can imagine at this moment.
Do you think that comes from your youth in the 90s?
Dancing, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like from reading some of your other work and knowing you as a person, that you were somewhat in touch with the rave scene in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I was a club kid in certain ways, certainly in Boston. And yeah, like that late night music where it's so layered that you know, it's like the horns, the air raid siren, the bump, 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 you know, and you're just like, yeah, there's a transcendence to that. And so I was, for so many years, trying to find a way to exist in those spaces. And this is actually in the freezer door a lot where, I'm like, I finally found somewhere I can dance where there's no smoke and no smoke machine. And then it's gone, right? And so, because I'm too sensitive for those spaces now, you know, having like devastating chronic health problems for the last, you know, decades now, and knowing what they come from, and like any hint of smoke in my environment, whether it's coming from outside or inside, is like destroying me for weeks. And so I kept trying to find those places in bars or in clubs, but they don't exist because clubs are not spaces where people are taking care of one another. It's just not, that doesn't exist. Like there are places where people get high and, you know, get smashed and try to, you know, overcome their inhibitions. And there's beauty there, but it's not a beauty that isn't going to destroy me. And so yes, I think when I first found like ecstatic dance, even though the music is nothing I would ever have danced to otherwise. And when I first walked in and I was like, what the hell are these people doing? They're like dancing to some, like, I don't know, like some song that's like the worst thing I've ever heard in my life, but they're loving it. And the thing that's amazing about it is it's like, you'll have like a 2-year-old and an 80-year-old. You'll have people who have like years and years of dance training and it's obvious, and you'll have people who clearly have never, you know, danced. And everything's together in that room. And so there is something, I know the limitations ahead, you know, like, but in the physical sense, it does offer so much. And I guess before the pandemic, I was really trying to think, well, what are other things I can do to have this in my life? And I was like brainstorming all different kinds of, you know, dance or public kinds of, you know, engagement in that way. But like I said, you know, like when the pandemic started, just like the door closed, like boom. And so it's hard, I think, because I do think, and I guess that's the thing with the freezer door, is what I have felt is that, I didn't think of this until I was doing readings, but I was like, the most successful embodiment in the book is the text itself. And because the text is also searching for its own embodiment, you know, and circling around itself and breaking off or becoming something else. And I feel like that is what people are responding to. Like they actually feel that. And like, oftentimes I feel like people who are not used to writing that is not, you know, written in a conventional form, you know, with a traditional narrative arc, like, you know, with explication and with like, you know, a, you know, resolution, they like resist it. And what's been fascinating to me, and I don't have all the explanation, but is that people are not resisting that in this case. And in many ways, this book is formally the most fractured, or, you know, like at times, as you know, it just like breaks off and becomes a conversation between an ice cube and an ice cube tray, right? And people love that part. And they, or, you know, like it suspends, you know, any kind of sense of, a traditional, you know, cause and effect kind of narrative form, other than the feeling itself, which is sort of creating the structure. And so I guess when I thought of that, that the text itself is the embodiment in a way that I'm searching for. I don't know. That's kind of exciting to me.
yeah, I didn't really think of that. You know, you talk a lot about embodied self in the book and just how disembodied the text is, how it is its own sort of embodiment, but it's just non-normative. Which reminds me of that passage when you're walking with this person, the man who is putting his tongue in your ass in the park, and then you're later running into him all over town, and you say sort of like, how could someone who's received the same information that I have end up reacting to things like the way that this guy does?
He's one of these people who like, he basically, everything that I hate is what he loves, but he thinks that we're agreeing. Mm-hmm. It's one of those people. Like, he's like, oh, I, you know, I don't generally read, you know, I read like philosophical work, but I did read one memoir recently that I just loved, and it was Patti Smith's Just Kids. And I have this narrative actually in the book where, because Patti Smith, I would say, you know, if there's any work that has been more damaging to the urban imagination over the last few decades, like, I would say that book has been the most damaging of anything I've read. I'm sure there are many others. But what the damage of it is that Patti Smith, you know, furthers this kind of myth of like New York as this place you just show up there. And, you know, she's of course talking about 60s, 70s. but like you just show up there with like a couple cents in your pocket, and then you're living at the Chelsea Hotel, and Janis is playing music in a room, and you go and you're like, hey Janis, and you're walking down the street, and you know, you meet some guy and he's like, I just stole a steak, and hey, you want to look it with me? And you're like, yeah, sure. And then, oh, it's Sam Shepard. And so the myth is that her like radiant talent, you know, enabled her to like rise to the pantheon of permanent stardom. And that if you have that radiant talent, then that will also bring you there. And so the irony, of course, is that he's trying to connect through the things that to me are the most like horrifying. And I feel like that's true a lot of times. You know, that, of course, is perhaps a trope of gay culture.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me just like white privilege. I haven't read Just Kids because I feel like people, it's all they've been able to talk about for the past decade or however long it's been out. Perhaps I've saved myself from having to undergo reading Just Kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think the myth that she's portraying is the idea that fame is a chain of coincidences. And she could reveal the mechanism of her stardom, but she reveals nothing. And simultaneously, she uses, because the book is about her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, and everyone knows that Robert Mapplethorpe was like, you know, ruthless in his pursuit of fame. And so she uses that ruthlessness to naturalize her, you know, it's like she wasn't pushing for this. It was just Robert, you know, and it's like, well, guess who, which one got famous? I mean, he got famous after he died, you know, but it's like she's also staking her claim, you know, to fame on his dead body, you know, and still unable to really conjure the fullness of his sexuality, which is where his work came from. I mean, I don't like Robert Mapplethorpe's work at all, but if you're going to talk about Robert Mapplethorpe's work, you can't be a prude, which is, you know, Patti Smith, you know, insists on remaining in that sort of like, ooh, like a little bit of like shame, you know, keep the shame, you know, beam on. And I guess for me, the point is not necessarily to talk about that work, although I can go on forever, but talk specifically about the violence of nostalgia, because I feel like people, and that's actually there. So it's very current right now, of course, because all people want now, they want to go back to quotation mark normal, right? And normal was already unlivable for so many of us. So we don't want to go back to quotation mark normal. But the nostalgia before this pandemic, of course, is often about, you know, the glory years, right? And the glory years change, but, you know, the 70s, of course, is one of these like mythological, you know, moments when people are like, oh, it was just, everything was possible and the rent was cheap and, you know, you could just go out in the street and find the, you know, the people. And I mean, I feel like now people mythologize the early 90s. And, you know, I was born in the 70s, so I can't speak from experience to that time period other than the trauma of being stuck, you know, in an abusive home or in a, you know, society that didn't want me to self-actualize, you know, or in a homophobic, you know, transphobic culture or whatever. But I can speak to the early 90s because those were the years that formed me. And when people romanticize the early 90s by saying, oh, you know, similar, it's a similar kind of romanticization. And sure, there were things that were possible in a different way. But what they leave out is that, you know, if you're a queer person, like, you know, I moved to San Francisco when I was 19 in the early 90s, and it felt like everyone was dying of AIDS, of drug addiction. And when people romanticize that time without coming to terms with the trauma, then it actually furthers the trauma. And so I think that's often what nostalgia does. It sort of packages this, you know, easily consumable product, you know, in replace embracement of the sort of complication, the nuance, the messiness, you know, on all levels. And so for me, I always want to write against nostalgia. And to me, the opposite of nostalgia is truth. And so that's what I'm looking for, whatever truth means, like truth in, like, I guess an embodied truth, right? Like a felt sense, a way of like looking at everything at once and not letting go or erasing or like pushing aside, you know, the entirety of our experiences.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. I think to me, then your work seems like an invitation to be honest and to be messy and to push back against this need to be pure or this like purity politics that exists right now, you know, need to like correct everything. I think you also touched about on that in the beginning of the book when you talked about your involvement in a transformative circle, being the friend of someone who had caused harm, and you kind of start to ask larger questions about like who isn't causing harm and how are we actually trying to help the people that have caused harm.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that part of the book in some ways was the hardest part of the book to write. It's a short section, but it I wrote it and then I took it out, and then I wrote it again, and then I took it out. And then one of my T. Fleischman, who was the last person to read the manuscript before it, you know, more or less was finalized, they were like, they actually commented on a different passage. It's a very quick one where I talk about going to a meeting for a new activist group, and they're like, oh, this is a scent-free space, and they're like really excited about that. And so I go into this space, and I get there, and I'm like, well, it smells really toxic in here. Can we open the windows? So we open the windows. It still smells really toxic, but it's like a little better. But in my mind, I was saying, well, they said it was a scent-free space, so they must be like working on that. And so I must just be overreacting because I'm, you know. And so in a way, it was serving the exact opposite purpose, which is to like make people who are chemically sensitive comfortable. It was actually making me comfortable in a totally toxic space. And I left that meeting and developed these migraines that have not gone away since. And that was like, you know, 7 years ago. And so I have this line where I say, there's the violence of the people trying to harm you and the violence of the people trying to help. And my T. Fleischman actually asked, are there other things like that? And I was like, oh no, I have to put that part again. And it's hard to write about something, you know, because this was a process that, you know, was very secretive and where we're not supposed to, of course, reveal details about the individuals. And so while it was going on, you know, I wasn't writing. And I guess it's interesting, I wasn't writing about it, I mean. And because I was like, what can I even say? I was even censoring myself. Mm. And I always, people ask about, like, when they're writing about people you know, they ask me this and I say, you know, they're like, what should you do? I say, write everything, you know, because you can always delete it. But in this moment, I was like, not writing anything. And so I'm trying to like do it. So I write about it in the freezer door in this very pared down way, because what I'm after is that feeling of like, in a way that even though the process was not about me, you know, I was participating in something that I really believed in, you know, and I was invited by a friend who had, you know, been abused, you know, in an intimate relationship. And there were, you know, four people that came together to have some sort of community accountability process. And I was like, initially just so excited, like, cause we were just going, you know, really deep right away, right? And that's what I miss about friendships is when, you know, immediately are talking about everything and feeling everything and sharing everything. But then it became this whole, pretty much, I guess, a mess, as many of these processes do. But in that case, and I guess I think in the book I say there's another place where it's just one sentence on a page, and it's in the middle of describing this. And I say, here is the gap where I don't know what I can tell you, so I'll just leave this gap, right? And so writing that page, that was when I was like, I'm actually able to conjure it. And I think the question I want to ask from that whole section, in a way, is, it's like, I guess, you know, I want to go into the failure of these queer dreams so that we can reimagine or reinvoke or reengage with the potential, right? But we can't get anywhere until we acknowledge and feel and move through the failure, and not in this aggrandized way, this like queer theory way of like, oh, failure is amazing. Like, failure is amazing when you're doing a performance, but it's not amazing when you're destroying people's lives, you know? And so for me, like, I want to map or describe or conjure these places of failure. And often in the book, I'm talking, it's the failure. I think that what I mentioned at the beginning where I say, I don't know if my body will ever have a home, right? And so the book, in a way, I'm trying to find that home, but finding that home is often so much about realizing, like you mentioned disembodiment, right? And so I guess realizing the lack, right? And that, because embodiment isn't only about pleasure. I mean, I wish it was, but it isn't. And so in order to try to get to the pleasure, I'm also going through all of the discomfort and fear and loneliness and desperation and alienation and some of these things I was listing earlier. Here they come again.
I think that's why the book has been so well received, Matilda, is that it's just very relatable, human, honest, you know, heavy and light and sobering at the same time. So I think the book allows people to sort of drop their shoulders, loosen their tie, kind of like step into thinking and feeling that it's okay to have conflicting views on things, particularly like desire, which, of you know, you've been talking about before and seems to be the central kind of thing that you're getting at in the book. You're questioning what is desire, and to me it seems that desire to you is this duality. You know, you're comparing and contrasting desire and possibility, desire and disgust, and you know, you're not sure if desire is freedom from bad things or if it's amnesia from bad things. Where did your fascination with desire or your need to kind of interrogate desire begin, do you think?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it began on the playground, you know, when kids would call me sissy and faggot and girl, and where I was persecuted for not being able to pass, to like exist within the violence of the masculinity that I was supposed to be part of. And I didn't really know what those words mean except that, you know? And then I remember like in the first sex ed class when they were describing homosexuality, and this is, I don't know, maybe fourth grade, so I was like 9 or something. And I was like, oh, well I guess that is what I am, you know, in a certain way. But how did these kids know? Because I didn't even know, you know? And so So I think in a way it started from that trauma and that confusion and that persecution. And in a way, I think in a more recent, you know, engagement, like let's say when I first entered the world as an avowedly queer person, you know, someone who believed in, you know, desire as a pathway toward connection, and where the desires that had always been evolved, you know, where I internalized like the larger, the message of, you know, of like, you know, school and city and country and family that were telling me I deserve to die for having these desires, that I, so once I let go of that, you know, when I, which is around the same time when I moved to San Francisco when I was 19, you know, it started a little before that, but I think, and that was the moment when I'm like, oh, so desire is all of this connection, right? It's not that desperation and loneliness and hopelessness and brokenness of childhood. It's the possibility of recognizing all of that brokenness and connecting in order to feel something else. And I think over the years since then, because, you know, that was, you know, almost 3 decades ago, like, I guess, you know, I've been feeling for a while, you know, a long time, that dream of the possibility of desire is not something that I have in my life in the ways that I want, and that exists. It doesn't exist, you know, in the ways that I want. And like the dreams, you know, of queerness, you know, or of faggotry or of queeniness, like, I guess I have those more in certain ways than the embodied sides. Well, I have the embodied sides, but without the connection with like, I guess, yeah, I guess it's that, you know, we all, or I won't say we all, but I will say that I was formed by trauma, and trauma is always there. And so there's the trauma of, you know, being sexually abused by my father. There's the trauma of a world that refused to acknowledge that, even when it was, I think in some ways, if I look at pictures of myself as a child, it's obvious, even just looking at the expression in my eyes, that something was going on. But, you know, the teachers at school, what they thought was going on that was the problem was that all my friends were girls, you know? And so they're like, let's assign some male friends, you know, that's going to fix it. Or like when I was 12 and reading War and Peace, they were like, oh, the problem is that, you know, I need to read, you know, like my grade level or something, you know, not the problem was the drama at home, right? And so I feel like, you know, for me, my queer dreams are about undoing that trauma and undoing that trauma together. And so I guess that's the, and I think there has been in my life, you know, a big separation, not always, but definitely more and more, between the places where desire is met and the places where like politics or emotions are met. And in the book, I think, you know, I'm trying, like, it's easier for me to find the politics and the emotional connection, and way harder to find the sexual connection. And so I'm trying to bridge the gap between those two so that I can exist in the world, in a, more complete way. And through that lens, cause you know, the lens is me and my body, but I'm also looking, you know, on the macro level at the same time, or feeling on that level, because I don't think you can't do that level separately from the body, right? And from all of those experiences.
Do you think the possibility for that exists in Seattle, in Capitol Hill?
I don't know.
Is that too fatalistic?
No, I think that's a great question. And I think that is the question of the book. And I think by extension, I would take it even broader and say, does it exist?
Thank you. The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
You need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the Frequency Modulation Band Radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
Welcome to Dragonroot Radio, Feminist Waves, brought to you by CKUT and the